And what we have is, this is another insurance day. And we've got actually two sets of bills that have been offered. And rather than go through every bill, and with, I think, a lot of the same people, I'm going to open a public hearing in any groups of bills and ask you to testify to them as a group. And so with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate bills 949, 950, 951, and 952. And yes, and I guessed absolutely right. So let's get Neil Jackson and John Powell. It looks like that's our primary, and Steve Merrill. These are our primary combatants on these bills. So let's come up together if we can, and let's talk about these issues. And I think, Mr. Jackson, you're representing the proponents.
That's correct.
So if you could give us a summary of each one of these bills as we go forward, I'll ask then Mr. Powell and Mr. Merle to respond, and then we'll have questions from the committee.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm here to speak on behalf of starting with Senate Bill 949. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what 949 does is makes uniform the method and manner which insurers will undergo arbitration with their own policyholders in the event of a dispute about personal injury protection, uninsured motorist coverage, or underinsured motorist coverage. Presently, we have a situation in this state where, frankly, I only know of one carrier who mandates a single arbitrator to decide these disputes. All the other carriers are pretty uniform, where they have three arbitrators, and the process of selection is when you have a disagreement with your carrier, for example, on a PIP dispute, they have determined from whatever method that they do not feel obligated to pay all of your medical bills. And so you ask for arbitration, and they say, fine. In all other situations but the one carrier, the claimant, the consumer, picks their arbitrator, the company picks their arbitrator, and then those two arbitrators agree on a third arbitrator, and then you proceed to set up your hearing and you proceed to arbitration. In addition, there's another glitch that we're dealing with now, where one carrier in particular, the arbitration system is set up so that it can be inexpensive and it can happen fast, so we can get these disputes done. And the statute mandates that the consumer only has to pay $100 towards the cost of the arbitration. One of the carriers out there is requiring the consumers to pay their doctors to testify, and that can be very expensive. For example, if you're disputing a $1,500 PIP bill and you've got to pay your doctor $1,250 to testify, it is hardly worth it to proceed. This bill addresses that problem and simply states that these arbitrations will be held according to our Uniform Trial Court rules and our Supplemental Local rules. Those rules say you can have a doctor's report, you don't have to bring the doctor in. Presently, as I said, the one carrier is requiring you to pay a doctor to come in on these disputes. Finally, this bill, what it does is, there is a decision that was recently handed down called the Barackman decision. That's the name of the consumer that was involved in that lawsuit. And this statute, this proposed bill, would make it so that whatever decision is made in these PIP arbitrations, which are generally, we try to make them inexpensive, we try to not pay doctors, and you're not usually arguing about a lot of money, but it will not bind either the insurance company or the consumer to the decision that is made in the arbitration at a later time if they have to go to litigation with the person who caused the accident and caused their injuries. The reason we suggest that is because you are dealing with a relatively smaller amount of money in these arbitrations, and you just don't gear up like you do when you're going to go to trial. So basically, those are the provisions of the bill. Mandates three-member arbitration panels, provides for local court rules and UTCR's Uniform Trial Court rules, which will govern them, and provides that the arbitration findings are not binding in subsequent litigation between the consumer and the person who caused the accident.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Northwest. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to let Mr. Merle discuss the bills, the details of these bills. But I would like to, again, remind the committee of the 30,000-foot level when it comes to these coverages, in particular PIP. As you know, Oregon is only one of 14 states that mandates PIP coverage, and of those 14 states, ours is one of the most comprehensive. Some states that have had this kind of coverage have repealed it because of the high cost. So I hope the committee would keep that in mind, because each of these bills will indeed increase the costs of these coverages. That I'd like to let Mr. Merle talk about the specifics of Senate Bill 949.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 949. To start out with, I know Mr. Jackson quite well, and I want to make it clear that I am not the unnamed company, State Farm.
I was going to ask.
Company
I agree with that.
So, we're here for different. We have some concerns about the bill. Mr. Jackson is correct. The consumer only has to pay $100 to get the arbitration heard. That's his expenses for the arbitrators. That leaves the insurance company with picking up the entire rest of the bill, and that's one of the concerns we have with the bill. Currently, our policy provides that if we don't reach another agreement with the consumer, we will use three arbitrators. The process is they select one, we select the one, the two of them select the third. The process kind of takes care of itself. Really, when you look at that with the odd number, the decision is really in the hands of that third person. As a result, quite often, when we can talk to the consumer, it's an issue where it may be suited to one arbitrator, we elect to go with one arbitrator. The reason for that is simple costs. Whatever the dispute resolution costs us, it eventually goes back into what rates cost consumers and what you charge for insurance. What you're finding today is that attorneys, all of the people who are acting as arbitrators, people like myself, people like Mr. Jackson, it's very common in the Portland metropolitan area and other places throughout the state for somewhere around $200 an hour to be charged for an arbitration. We look at the arbitration we have and kind of gauge ourselves as whether it's one, we need one person, three person. Can we agree on one person and just have it cheaper? And if we can reach that agreement, we want to do that. I wouldn't want to foreclose that from anybody being able to do that and being able to have just one person, because it saves expenses and I think your results are probably the same. You look at the selection of the arbitrator when you get to a single person, basically you're both going with somebody you feel is objective when that happens. Currently, our policy does say that we use the rules of evidence if we can't reach some other agreement for who comes and testifies, how you present evidence. That's how Mr. Jackson's talking about it occurs, that some people in the industry will require doctors to come testify. If you're using the Uniform Trial Court rules, it's a much more relaxed procedure. And in some cases, that's good. In some cases, the issue is not that big of an issue. You want to have relaxed procedures and go ahead and have the arbitration occur. Sometimes, however, it's complex, and you do need to have live witnesses there. What the current statute allows us to do, and our policy allows us to do by using the rules of evidence, is we can go ahead and engage and reach agreement with the other attorney, with people like Mr. Jackson, say, this is a simple one. Let's go ahead and have these relaxed procedures. Or this is a complicated one, and the doctors need to be there live, because in order for the decision makers to have the kind of input they need to make a good decision, they need to be there live. By removing it and going to Uniform Trial Court rules, you're going to go relaxed procedures every time. Now, an interesting thing about Uniform Trial Court rules, if you use them, that you should understand is currently there's two things in the Uniform Trial Court rules. First of all the cases that are heard in court that are under $50,000 in some jurisdictions, I think there's some jurisdictions that still have a smaller threshold of $25,000, are arbitrated before they're allowed to go to trial by a single arbitrator. Give the parties a chance to go ahead and have one person hear their case and render a decision. Lots of times that terminates the case and doesn't need to go any further. But it is a single arbitrator in those cases that hears it, and both parties have a hand in selecting it. The second thing about it is that those cases have a limited dollar threshold. They're $50,000 or less in the most extreme circumstance, so it makes more sense to have relaxed procedures. And anybody that's not happy with the result has an absolute right to appeal to go to a trial. I don't think transplanting that kind of procedure into the UM arbitration statutes is wise, because you lose the flexibility to adjust case by case on where you need to go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Mazza.
Just so that I can sort of have an idea, how many claims does, say, State Farm have, and then how many of those, or what percentage are arbitrated, and how many, I mean, are we talking thousands?
Chair Metzger, Senator
Ron
Anderson, you're more in the hundreds.
Okay.
It's more in the hundreds. The vast majority of cases are resolved informally. Mr. Jackson couldn't make a living at it, and we couldn't afford to sell you the coverage if it wasn't otherwise.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. To you, Mr. Merle. So is it the three arbitrator requirement or the changing of the rules of evidence that you're most concerned about? I mean, you're concerned about both, but...
If I had to make a choice, the biggest concern I had would be the rules of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are cases where that flexibility is needed to be more strict and more relaxed.
Okay. And then you also pointed out that, I don't know if you can verify what Mr. Jackson said, that and he pointed out there was only one carrier that was doing this. And so just for prima facie, let's say that's true, and that it is just one that is that. So that the industry standard clearly would be the three-arbiter system, keeping in mind that they may get together and end up selecting one at the end of the day, but at least that's the standard. So what would be what would be wrong with going to that standard, especially if going to it did still allow permissively the ability to, in some cases, have one, but establish that as a standard?
Chair Metzger, I think you could do that and do like State Farm does now, where we have in our policy, and but you have the option of saying, hey, this case really fits a one-arbiter deal. And it's actually the benefit to the plaintiff in that case is it's probably going to happen quicker because you're not coordinating three attorney schedules as opposed to one.
Mm-hmm.
And our main concern, I think, would be to have that as an option, not to foreclose that,
mm-hmm.
At least from a State Farm standpoint, because, as we're sitting here, it isn't our policy that way today. We use three arbiters.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Jackson, you might comment on that?
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Morrell, and, in fact, those of us who do this, we, on occasion, even though the policy will provide for three, we will agree to do one. This would not preclude that from happening. If the parties stipulate to anything, the statute can say what it says, but they can go ahead and do what they've agreed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it. A lot of my colleagues have done it. And I agree with them. There are some cases that we decide we've got to bring the doctor in because it's a complex issue. But the fact of the matter is this wouldn't preclude an agreement to use one in the appropriate case. And I've done it before.
Yeah.
All of us have.
Could you comment on the Mr. Merle's comment about the changing of the evidence standard?
I'm not sure that... Again, it's just one carrier and it's not Mr. Merle's company that is doing this. I guess my reaction to that would be this standard, since State Farm and 99.9% of all the other carriers use those rules anyway, I don't understand the opposition to it. I can understand from the one carrier that objects to using those rules. But, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you need to understand, these are the rules that we use every day in the court arbitration proceedings, and that's what Mr. Merle was talking about. These are the same rules we use on every case that mandatorily must go to arbitration in the court system. Those are the rules we use. If we can use them in the court system, how come we can't use them when we have a dispute between the insured and their own carrier?
Other questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the average cost of one of these arbitration proceedings?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, they vary a lot. But if you're looking at three arbitrators, I think most of these happen in a day. I don't think most UM arbitrations happen for more than a day, and the hearing is probably less than a day. But when you're looking at what you're paying for prep time and the work afterwards, I think you're paying for a day. So I think you're looking at probably a good 8 hours by every arbitrator on the average that is put in and billed. And again, that the hearing isn't that long,
right.
But that's the entire process.
So, 16. Round number cost?
3 times $1,600. So that's like $4,800 on an average case.
And in the way that the process works today, who's responsible for that cost?
I pay $4,700 of it, and Mr. Jackson's client pays $100 of it.
That's the way that it is today.
That's the way it is today.
And how does this bill change that?
Well, this bill doesn't change that because that's the assumption that we just made is you're using a three-panel arbitration. This bill says that's what you do. What if the carrier that uses one arbitrator, you can cut that by a third. They would pay $1,600 for one arbitrator because there wouldn't be the other two involved. So that would be the cost difference.
I see.
Other questions? Just one final question, Mr. Merle. On Mr. Jackson's rebuttal regarding the evidence standard that is used in court every day, would you want to maybe clarify with me what you think really is the extra cost involved there?
Chair Metzger, not so much the extra cost, but I think it's the quality of process.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you do need to have the evidence there. You know, to me, today, the case has to be under $50,000 to use the relaxed rules. That's the threshold in court. And so in any case that's over $50,000, it's going to have full evidentiary rules apply.
Okay. Other questions on this bill? Okay. Let's move on to Senate Bill 950. Mr. Jackson.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in favor of Senate Bill 950. I will point out to the chairman and the committee that there is some pending amendments that we're having worked on right now to the original bill as submitted. As submitted, what the proposal does is, let me lay out the scenario quickly. When you get in an accident and you're injured and you go ahead and fill out your PIP application, you ask your carrier to pay your medical bills and lost wages and babysitters and the other things that the statute requires to be paid, what happens is that if you go to an attorney, the attorney would have to, one of the things the attorney would do would be to notify the PIP carrier and say, hey, I represent this person now. How do you want to recover the PIP benefits that you've paid? Because the way the statute works right now is the PIP carrier in most situations is entitled to be reimbursed for the amounts that they pay for medical bills and for lost wages. You notify them of the claim. They have 30 days to decide how they wish to recover. The problem is, again, I hate to keep saying it, but it's true, there's one particular carrier out there that either will not make an election or they will send you a letter within 30 days and say, we do not choose to make an election at this time. And here's why that's important. Under the statutes, there are three ways that the PIP carriers can get their money back. One of the ways they can do it is by direct intercompany reimbursement. Most of the companies are members of the Interstate Compact or members of an arbitration group where they have agreed that they will, if they have a dispute between the liability carrier and the PIP carrier, they'll resolve that dispute between them. That's fine. That's one of the methods. Another method is that the carrier can elect to recover by lien. And how that works is they notify their insured's attorney, we want to recover by lien. We want you to recover the money for us. If they do it that way, in that case, they're then required to pay a proportionate share of the attorney's fees incurred in getting that money back for them, as well as a proportionate share of costs. The third way is by subrogation, and it really doesn't, we don't need to talk about it because it's not affected by this bill. What the problem is when the carriers do not elect how they want to recover their money and say, we're not going to say right now, or just don't say at all, then the consumer's attorney, who is representing them, goes forward with the case, and the policy that the consumer has with their insurance company says that the consumer must protect the insurance company's interest in any benefits they've paid. So unfortunately, what ends up happening is, and this has happened a lot, it's happened to me, it's happened to all my colleagues, you will go ahead, you will finish the case, and you may settle the case. Let's say the PIP carrier has paid $10,000 in medical bills, and they wouldn't tell you how they wanted their money recovered. They said, we're not going to tell you, or said nothing. You have to protect the insurance company because that's protecting your client. So you recover not only the pain and suffering damages that you negotiate with the liability carrier, you also recover the PIP amount. Then what happens is the PIP carrier steps forward with a handout and says, give us all our money and we don't have to pay you anything. The problem with that is, technically, that obligates the consumer to pay their attorney for recovering the money for the insurance company, and the insurance company doesn't have to pay anything for that recovery. What this bill requires is that they make that election, and as presently written, if they don't make that election within 30 days, the recovery will be by lien. And what that means is that the consumer's attorney will go ahead and recover the money, but then the insurance company, they'll get theirs, but they're going to have to pay proportionate costs and attorney's fees for the recovery that was made for their benefit. I won't address the amendments because they haven't been drafted yet, but that's what the bill as written would do right now. And from our perspective, it's simply a matter of fairness. if the consumer is going to hire the lawyer who's going to make the recovery for the insurance company, all they have to do is tell us, we don't want to recover by lien, we want to recover by direct intercompany reimbursement. We're out of it then. We don't recover it for them, we're not entitled to get paid for it. But in those situations where they refuse to elect or don't do anything, if the recovery is made, they ought to pay the person who recovered it for them. And that's what the bill does.
Gentlemen, you heard Mr. Jackson feels, you know, they're doing work for you to recover your monies. So you might have an opposing view, so I'm going to give you a chance to do that.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. I'm glad actually to hear Mr. Jackson's testimony because I didn't understand his bill as being after what he is after. I'm a little bit concerned, though, and I kind of disagree with some of what he said, and maybe it provides some ground on where to go with this bill. Is my understanding is that we have the three methods of recovery: direct reimbursement, a lien, or else what the third method, which I typically call subrogation. The first method allows for a carrier to recover directly from another carrier, and what that does is it keeps money moving between consumers and insurance companies, which the result of that is there's no money taken out of it, so that your rates are impacted by what your recoveries are when it offsets against what you pay. And that's the advantage of using it for both the consumers and the industry. Occasionally, there'll be reasons that you need either assert a lien, in which case we'll pay Mr. Jackson an attorney fee for the recovery, and we lose some money doing that. So if you don't need to assert a lien, you'd prefer not to because it's a better recovery. The third method, which he described to you, is subrogation, where if a carrier does not elect one of the other two methods or for some reason it's not available to them, there are some glitches in the statute where depending on who you're recovering that money from, you may not have the other two methods available from you. Allow for the consumer to go ahead and get that money through litigation and hold it in trust. My reading of that statute, however, is if they use an attorney to do that, the carrier pays their proportionate attorney's fees and costs in proportion to the rest of the recovery out of that fund. And that's how I understand that statute works. When somebody does that with State Farm, that's how we do it. The thing I'm concerned about, if we, in the bill's present form, is that we have had a lot of attorneys who have been trying to keep us from recovering our subrogation and have had some artful arguments in doing it. I think the current structure of the statute has defeated some of those arguments. If you're going to go this type of route, I think one of the things on a direct reimbursement, there's a glitch in the statute currently where if somebody pays policy limits, carrier pays Mr. Jackson $25,000 for the whole amount of money they have, then they don't have to honor our direct reimbursement. We're kind of stuck with not being able to get a lien and having to go through subrogation. But we would not have a problem if Mr. Jackson actually recovers the money because we haven't selected the other two methods if you pay an attorney fee. But that's not what I understood this bill to be doing. I understood this bill to actually kind of flip some administrative requirements where you could actually miss getting your money back, period. And that was our concern about it.
Mr. Jackson, would you respond to Mr. Merle's comment that, you know, we split the cost, that's what the statute requires? The comment about whether it is in fact that's what the statute does require, and or number two, regardless of what it does or not, you would seem to suggest that there are carriers that aren't doing that.
Mr. Merle's company is not the company, again, that I'm talking about.
Okay.
And I have a little disagreement with Mr. Merle's interpretation of the third method and subrogation. It's my belief, and I've had to do some research on it, it's my belief that the subrogation only applies where the consumer is not going after a recovery. That then allows the company to actually step into the shoes of the consumer and recover the funds that they have paid for medical bills and whatever other items that they have paid for. That's the third method. Again, the problem is the way the statutory scheme is set out, this bill as written, simply addresses a fact where they refuse to say which method they choose to pursue to get their money back, because it ties persons in my position up in knots. Because am I supposed to be getting the money? Well, I have to protect my client. And then when I get the money, then they come forward with their hand out and say, hey, give us all the money. And I say, you owe me an attorney's fees. I recovered that money for you. Oh, no, we don't. We don't have to pay you. And right now, we haven't been able to force them to pay.
And how widespread, in terms of the broad carriers, has this problem been?
again, I only know of one carrier. They routinely do it. They either ignore those notice letters or they send back a letter and say, we choose not to elect at this time. And they do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. I cannot remember the last time I received a letter from that carrier where they said, we elect this method. They say, we don't have to choose how we're going to do it, so we're not going to choose that. And they wait until we've made the recovery, and then they say, give it all to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're fortunate. One thing is that that carrier apparently doesn't dispute the bill, so that gives us some working room. So, and my own, as I will publicly admit, my own insurance company seems to be doing the right thing, and I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Questions of this issue? Well, it sounds to me that there's some things we can do here. I would ask, and we're under short time frame, but I mean, fair is fair, and it sounds like, and we may hear this in the next couple of bills, that most people understand what fair is. So to the extent that we have to make some limitations to make sure that everybody understands that same rules, I think we can maybe pursue that. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
If we get the amendments back, is there something then that you wouldn't oppose the bill if the amendments are the way that Mr. Jackson
says? Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair Starr, I don't know anything about the amendments, so I have no way of knowing whether we would agree, but it seems to me that there could be a fairly simple fix to the situation that was outlined. Somebody that waits until the last minute and the funds are collected through the attorney in this case. Seems like you'd want to fix that spot, which then would take away any advantage to not selecting.
Right. Yeah.
And shoot it with a rifle rather than a shotgun.
Yeah. Let's solve that problem. Okay. Right. Can we do that? Thank you very much. Let's move on to Senate Bill 951. Mr. Jackson.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a member of the Board of Governors, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 951. This bill does two things. It fixes two problems that have come up in the last few years about the coverages that are available to Oregon consumers. The first fix in this bill is the family members limitation fix. Right now, if you and your wife or you and your spouse are driving down the road and the driver loses control of the vehicle, takes out a tree, and the spouse passenger is severely injured, the limitation that you will find in the policy as far as what the injured spouse can claim under the policy is $25,000. Even though you have $100,000 liability coverage, because it is your spouse or a family member sitting next to you, you will only be able to recover $25,000 no matter how severe the injury is. Consumers, I've talked to a lot of people as we were developing this bill, and everybody that I have told, were you aware that if you're driving down the road with your wife or husband, and if they wipe out and you get severely injured, you don't get your liability limits. You get $25,000.
Is that, by the way, same for your kids, too?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
It's for your children, too.
How about non-relatives?
No. Relatives living in the same household. Those are the ones where this limitation applies. We think that needs to be fixed because there is no consumer out there in this state that knows that if it's your neighbor, they can make a $100,000 claim. But if it's resident of the family member, resident of the household, $25,000, that's all you get. The bill proposes that simply that a family member, they can't reduce the limits below the liability limits just because the person injured is a family member. The second part of the bill deals with the situation where you have, let's say you're really insured. You've got a lot of assets and you want to have your basic policy of $100,000, $300,000, and then you buy an umbrella policy of $1 million because you want that coverage there. You want to be protected. And you're driving down the road. You're going home from Salem, and a state employee loses control of their car and takes you out. In that situation, what you would normally expect to do is you can go ahead and you're severely injured, you're quadriplegic, whatever. In that situation, you would fully expect that you could make your claim against the government vehicle. You could then go to your own policy for your underinsured motorist coverage up to the limits of $1 million, because that's what you bought. It's not the way it works. The Patty Surface case came down, and our court has said that because we are dealing not with an insurance policy, but we are dealing with a governmental entity, and because the limitations of the liability that the governmental entity has is regulated by the Tort Claims Act, you can go ahead and recover up to the $200,000 allowed under the Tort Claims Act, in my scenario, from the state. But you cannot make a claim against your own policy for all that excess coverage that you bought. This bill fixes that and basically says that it doesn't matter if it's a governmental entity that hits you. It's to be treated just as if that was insurance, and you can then go to your excess policy and make your claim up to the limits of your policy. And those are the two fixes in Senate Bill 951, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Gentlemen.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. The one thing is, before I actually get to talking to the two fixes the bill does, I think is important, both for this bill and the other bills that I'd like to leave you with, is that auto insurance is not the only solution when somebody gets injured for compensation. And I think that's an important thing to keep in your mind as I go through and talk about the rest of the things that we have to talk about. Currently, there is a limitation for family members that almost every carrier puts in their policy. They limit it to the financial responsibility limits of $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident that we're required by law to provide coverage for anyone that drives on the road of at least those minimum amounts. And that's what the current law is. Prior to that case decision determining that financial responsibility applied to family members as well as non-family members, the insurance companies for years have had family member exclusions where it was zero, nothing for when somebody gets injured in a family. The reason for that is twofold. One is family member suits are just not, and family members collecting compensation, at least when you're living in the same household, it's a contentious thing. It's a bad thing for the families. And then secondly, it's also a situation where you can have considerable fraud going on and difficulty handling those claims because people are in the same household. That's the purpose behind those exclusions. We still feel like that those are valid reasons to have that kind of limitation and allow us to limit what we want to provide for that particular exposure. The second component of what Mr. Jackson is talking about is I think it's a frustration bill that stems from the fact that the state of Oregon, although it has the ability to pay for its claims, has limited liability. That was put into our Constitution when the state became a state, that the state was immune from liability, period, until the legislature made provision for some form of suit. The legislature has done that under the Tort Claim Act, but it's been a limited waiver of immunity. Some states, like the state north to us, Washington, the state south to us, California, have made unlimited waiver of immunity. They said that it's good that the state be like anyone else and pay for what they're responsible for. You take that immunity that the state had, and you come up to the day that in the 60s, late 60s, when Oregon went ahead and mandated uninsured motorist coverage, and the immunity of the state was recognized, and because of that, in the uninsured motorist statute, it said a government car is not an uninsured car. The reason being is, at that time, you couldn't legally collect from a government car. Almost simultaneous with the passage of the UM law, the legislature enacted the limited waiver of immunity. It says now you get some compensation from the state. Later on, when the state went ahead and put the underinsured motorist laws into force, that concept carried over. You get what the state allows you to have for their limited waiver of immunity. I'm here to tell you I think it's a bad public policy decision to transfer the responsibility of payment onto the victim's insurance. The victim, yeah, gets more compensation. They get more compensation depending on what they buy. But the problem with doing that is as you go to law school, Mr. Jackson and I went to law school, part of our first classes that we took was torts, which that's when somebody gets an accident, you're able to sue. And the reason for our tort system existing that is you go over in those early days of law school is you want to have compensation from victims, and you also want to mold conduct of defendants. The way you mold conduct of defendants to get them to live up to better standards of care is to go ahead and make them pay for what they're responsible for. And you don't transfer that back onto the victim. the component that he's talking about here would transfer that back onto the victim, and for that reason I think it's a bad public policy decision that really goes to the foundations of the tort system. I think the decision that you should make is limited waiver of immunity a good idea? And if it is, keep it enforced. Don't change the UIM laws and circumvent that public policy. But if it isn't a good idea, handle it through the Tort Claim Act by expanding the limits.
Thank you, Mr. Earl. The issue of fraud, and I understand what you're saying on that, but of course, being in the insurance business, you face fraud all the time. I mean, that's one of the key components in which you're vigilant on, and I'm sure you spend lots of resources in all lines of insurance is to protect against that. And I guess the one thing regarding the family member that I have a little difficulty with on that particular aspect of it is to think that the burden then should be placed on, you know, your insured as opposed to on you to have used to suspect fraud to be able to investigate and if in case believe it's fraud, you know, not pay the claim or have that adjudicated some other way, rather than just basically eliminating those levels of coverage simply because they're a family member, because, you know, we don't want to have to deal with a fraud component. And I don't know, it just seems that part of it, I'd like to, John, I see you want to jump in here. Give me your kind of thinking on that, because that one does seem troubling to me.
I can understand that, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Northwest. Mr. Chairman, basically, I think the answer to that is that the other coverages in the auto policy cover everyone, including PIP. It covers all your passengers and yourself as the driver who may have lost control. The consumer protects those in their automobile by buying higher limits of that coverage. So you can, in fact, on the medical side. In addition, most people have health insurance in addition to that for their family, which then would take over after any PIP payments were exhausted on the medical side. The limitation here is the liability portion, allowing somebody to come in and sue you for things that could be in addition to your out-of-pocket expenses, in essence. So I think historically the law has said family members. It's an odd situation where a family member is suing another one, and we know that unfortunately happens in some cases. But in a case where there are other forms of reimbursement available and other ways of protecting your family and people in your automobile, I think it would be a mistake to open this up.
Mr. Jackson, I have a question for you, then I'll ask members of the committee if they have questions. The tort issue with the state, would that require a constitutional amendment to make any modifications in that at all? Make the state be as responsible?
I think it's statutory.
Okay.
It's statutory.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just curious as to, on that component of the bill, representing the association, what your thoughts would be about changing that tort law to make the state as responsible as any other private party for injuries sustained by someone in the course of duty as an employee of state?
My response is yes, we'd be in favor of it simply because we think that everybody ought to be responsible for what they do, including the state. But right now we're dealing with the situation where the person can't even make the claim on their own policy, Mr. Chairman, because they are precluded because it happens to be a government vehicle that hit them. And therefore, the coverage that they paid for, they don't get. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to address that specific problem. Keep in mind, they paid premiums for that $1 million coverage. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're asking for something that we feel they should not contractually be entitled to. They paid the money. But unfortunately, with the surface case at the present, there's not going to be any recovery on the excess over what they can obtain from the state.
Questions from the committee? Senator Starr.
Thank you. I guess I've got a question about costs. I'm always cognizant of adding additional costs to insurance policies, recognizing the ability of the public to buy and are already too high uninsured out there. Can you comment on this bill specifically, what added costs may be ensued if this were to be passed?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I can't quantify it for you. I can tell you that we did have a time where we were paying family members because of an error in language in our policy from a published case. I think it was a Wright versus State Farm here, and I was surprised how many cases we had with family members that applied to. I thought it was much smaller than what it was. With the state, we have a much less of a handle on that cost because we don't have any way to identify those claims. They just happen. They're not covered. Although Mr. Jackson's correct, people pay premiums for their coverage. Their premiums are never calculated anything to do with the state because we always calculate premiums off of losses. And the state, from the inception of the UM and UIM laws, was not... We didn't pay the claims where the state was involved, and because of that, the premiums have never factored that in because it's not part of the loss picture.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Is there no way that we could quantify? I mean, is there give some ballpark of an idea what this possibly could mean?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I can check and see. That's something where I'll have to go to other people and see if we actually have a reliable way to mine that data and then tell you how much it is. But I don't know right now today.
But as far as the state vehicle crashing into your car, that's not included in your rates now anyway.
Chairman, that's correct. And I know that we don't have a reliable way to mine that data.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll now move into Senate Bill 952. Mr. Jackson. Unless you want to withdraw Senate Bill 952, we'll talk about it.
Let me get organized here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 952. The purpose of this bill is to deal with the situation on, again, whether or not the issue here is whether or not there will be reimbursement to the PIP carrier in the event that the injured person recovers from the at-fault insurance company. And then let me create the scenario for you. There's an accident. The insured has a $50,000 policy. The injured party has a $50,000 policy, which they have purchased. The person that struck them has a minimum policy of $25,000. The insured's damages, counting economic damages only, let's say are $49,950. That's the total medical bills, lost wages. Those are economic damages. They make the claim against the $25,000 liability policy and recover the $25,000. They then go to their own carrier to make an underinsured claim for up to the $50,000 limit. Now, the underinsured claim, their own carrier is going to get a credit for the $25,000 that the liability carrier paid. So the exposure to their own company is the remaining $25,000 and $25,000 is $50,000. The statute presently provides that in that scenario, the carrier, their own carrier, is going to be able to deduct everything that they have paid, the $49,950, and the balance is all the consumer is going to get. What this statute does is it changes that to say that instead of using the policy limits of your own policy as the top amount, what we're going to look at is we're going to look at your total damages that you suffered in this accident. If you got $49,950 in medical bills, I posit in this situation, you've got a lot of other damages, non-economic damages that you've suffered. You've been in the hospital for a long time. You've probably had surgeries. You've had a long period of recovery. Yet because you are under the $50,000 threshold presently, that's the extent of the claim that you can make. The change is you would take all the damages into account. You would take the non-economic damages, the pain and suffering, plus the economic damages. You add those all together. What the total of that is will determine whether or not the reimbursement, the PIP carrier is entitled to reimbursement for the sums that they've paid. So if, for example, it's decided by arbitration or whatever means that this person is entitled to $100,000 for pain and suffering and for the medical bills and the lost income. All the damages were $100,000. They could then make a full $50,000 recovery, taking the liability policy and the remaining $25,000. They would get closer to being fully reimbursed is what it comes down to. Presently, if your economic damages are below the limits, you have to pay the PIP carrier back, and that just cuts that much down about how much you recover, no matter how badly you were hurt. Doesn't matter. It's the economic damages that determine whether there's reimbursement or not. This bill changes and says it should be the total damages. There is a glitch in our statute, and it's a glitch the courts have recognized. In those scenarios, it would be actually be better for the injured person that they were hit by an uninsured person, as opposed to a person who just has the $25,000. Because if it's an uninsured person, they can make a full recovery. But if they have the minimum coverage, they can't. And so we're trying to basically say what applies to uninsured applies to underinsured, and we ought to take the total damages the person has suffered. Figure that out before we just start talking about reimbursement back to the insurance company for PIP payments.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Sure, counterpoint. Mr. Member Kennedy's again, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. In starting out, I'd like to just go ahead and talk to the committee a little bit about what I understand the current state of the law and how this bill will alter it, because it's a little bit different than what I thought I heard Mr. Jackson say as to what my understanding of it is. Current state of the law is that a PIP carrier recovers the amounts they paid back from the other insurance carrier for the guilty party. What that does is it makes the guilty party responsible, and it factors into his rates and his company's experience for what that costs in the end of things, because the PIP carrier gets their money back. That was an important part of the PIP Act when it was originally put into place in 1973. The biggest problem that the legislature saw, and if you look at the committee meeting minutes from 1973, was, can we afford this? If we mandate this coverage, are people in Oregon going to be able to afford to buy auto insurance? And they felt like having subrogation and recovering that money back from the guilty party's insurance company was something that would make that work. And in fact, it has for over 30 years now. For 30 years, we've had a very solid PIP system in the state of Oregon. And this bill and a number of other bills in the building have been kind of tinkering with that, and we get very concerned about what that will do to the cost of insurance. In 1973, when the PIP Act was enacted, the statute basically said the PIP carrier gets their money back no matter what. And up until 1993, the insured could be out of pocket, still some economic loss, and the PIP carrier would get their money back. This body in 1993 took a look at the law again and said, hey, it's an important part of the PIP statute and how keeping this coverage affordable, but there needs to be some fairness here. What we have today is the insurance company gets back their PIP payments only if the expenses that the person has for economic loss is satisfied. So all the medical bills have to be paid, you have to be made whole in your lost wages, and any other kinds of things that you can go ahead and tag within the name of economic damages have to be made whole. And then when that happens, we're not going to be as concerned about pain and suffering money, because we want people to be made whole first. Then the insurance company gets their money back after the person's made whole, and that helps all of Oregonians because it keeps this coverage affordable. What I see this bill doing is it removes that limitation of economic damages. It's going to say you have to be made whole on all damages. There's two problems with that. The first one is, when is that person made whole? We argue about that and go to court quite often to figure out what the right amount that somebody is owed. And if you're going to put the PIP carrier in that position, we're going to have a lot of disputes on getting where we need to be to figure out whether or not we're entitled to recoveries. Or somebody may just say, I'm not going to try to get my recovery, which then again factors into rates. The other thing is it does is it will minimize PIP recoveries, and that was a cornerstone of what came into reducing insurance costs. Now, what will this do as far as an exact cost for you? I can't tell you. I have worked in other states where, by case decision, they had this kind of rule, and the PIP coverages and liability coverages both are much more expensive in that state, which is the state of Washington. I think we actually, if you look at our PIP Act, and you look at, I worked under the Washington PIP Act for 5 years as a management person, we have a much more affordable, a much better model as far as helping our consumers, and it's delivered at a much better cost.
and you can opt out of Washington.
That's true. And in Washington, you also can opt out of the coverage, and even with people being able to say, I don't want PIP coverage, their coverages are still more expensive.
Okay. Interesting. Questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we have some things to chew on there. Committee members, we're going to go into the next series of bills, and you'll be pleased to see that our combatants are signed up as together on the rest of the bills. So it's always good to know that it isn't always the same. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bills 949, 950, 951, 952. Open the public hearing on Senate Bills 922, 923, 924, 925, and 926. And I'm going to try to work this out. We've got, with one exception, we have essentially the same people in all of them. So I think I will start with, we have Wendy, and they're all signed up in support of this, of these bills, with one exception. So Wendy Johnson, Joel DeFore, Stephen Merle, Neil Jackson, if you would come forward, and since you're all proponents, if there is one of the four wants to stand down, since we don't have anyone testifying in opposition, that might be helpful. Okay? And if we need the testimony, we'll take it, but I'm just trying to streamline here, streamlining government.
Great.
And I think what I'd, we're going to start off with Senate Bill 923 and go until we get to 26, and then we'll come back at the end to 922 because we have one opponent to 923. So let's start with 923.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Commission, serving as the deputy director. And my testimony will be very brief. I just want to explain how these five bills came before you today. As I said, they do come with the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission, and this is the first time the Law Commission has been in this committee, although I recognize some of the members from other committees. Some of you may not know that the Law Commission was not created until 1997, and we were created in 1997 by the Legislative Assembly to actually assist the Assembly. Our job is to do a continuous system of law reform and improvement for the state. The Legislative Assembly recognized in 97 that there are fewer and fewer lawyers in the state and that the ORS does not get reviewed systematically, and there are lots of areas of laws that are broken. And so our job is to work through those issues. We're a 13-member commission, which includes two members appointed by the Senate. Your senators are Senator Kate Brown and Senator Vicky Walker. Two members are appointed by the Speaker of the House. One is appointed by the Governor, the Chief Justice, the Attorney General. Each of Oregon's three law schools have the deans or a designee of the law school. And then three members are appointed by the Oregon State Bar. For this automobile insurance project, Martha Walters, an attorney in Eugene, was appointed by the Oregon State Bar, and she served as chair of this project. We have a really small staff, just myself and Associate Dean David Kanenge at Willamette University College of Law, and an assistant as well. We're housed over across the street at the law school, and we have an interesting funding arrangement. We have a 50-50 partnership between the state of Oregon and Willamette University, funding half of our budget. We were funded first in 2000, so this is our third session, but second funded session. We do law reform in a variety of areas. You'll see bills this session for everything from juvenile law to civil rights to eminent domain and these five automobile insurance bills. Our process is that we identify an area of law, we research the area, we marshal the experts. With our small staff, you can imagine that what we really rely on is volunteers, and we're very thankful for the number of attorneys and interested persons who participated in this project. We had plaintiff's lawyers, defense lawyers, members from the insurance industry, members from the state, DCBS, all involved in this project, so that we can provide a, what we hope is a consensus product before you. Our priority is private law issues that affect a large number of Oregonians, or a public law area that doesn't have a natural lobbying group or an agency that will put forth the bill. Each of the issues before you today are a little more controversial perhaps than some of our issues that you'll see this session, but there are areas that are broken. When I took this job at the Law Commission, one of the things that the justices at the Supreme Court where I was working suggested was, if you have some time, look at those automobile insurance statutes. They're really difficult to read and they involve a lot of litigation. So most of the bills before you today actually have a court case that goes with them to explain the problem. The Law Commission is created to assist the legislature, as I explained, and so we feel very strongly about showing our thought process and what went into each bill. So prior to this hearing, I provided you each with a report explaining each bill, and I submit those again today so they can be submitted as written testimony. They explain our process of going through the bill, the problem in the law, and our solution. So I'll submit those again for the record. Mr. Chair, you asked that we provide plaintiff's lawyers, defense lawyers, and insurance industry representative for each bill. And so I'll leave the details of each of these five bills to those three folks, and those would be Joel DeVore to my right and Neil Jackson and Steve Murrell.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Murrell, Mr. Jackson, would you come forward so we have you all here? And again, we'll start with Senate Bill 923. And Mr. DeVore, I guess you're going to be the leadoff hitter, I understand.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just kind of do the nuts and bolts to introduce you to the bills, then there may be comments from my colleagues here. Yes. My one word of introduction for all of these five proposals, which involve six problems, is to say, you know, when we drive home today, we'll be driving in our cars with lots of confidence that our car is going to work. If our car insurance that you and I each have were like our car, what I would have to tell you about and warn you about is your car insurance is a lot like your car with the lug nuts loose on your front wheel and a problem in your front steerage. And if you hit a pothole just wrong, your car insurance can hurt you bad. And what we're talking about, five or six problems, most of which are hurting your clients, your constituents, our consumers generally of insurance. I should say, I'm an attorney in private practice with Lubos Cobb, which is a firm in Eugene, Oregon. I have no particular axe to grind. Most of our work that Lubos Cobb does historically was insurance defense work. I happen to do a lot of coverage work. I represent both injured plaintiffs as well as insurance companies. 923. Thank you for skipping 922. It takes a little more discussion.
Yeah.
923 is. I admire your courage because you're starting with one of those most confounding things to explain. It deals with something I call the matching minimum limits multiple claimants problem, and what it has to do with uninsured and underinsured. Emphasis on underinsured motorist coverage that you and I have. Now, and this has to do with fixing. Something that you as the legislature did in 1997, but did not do completely. We changed some language in ORS 742.502 in order to solve this problem, but there was similar language in an earlier paragraph of 502 that we need to change to make sure the change is complete. And here's how the problem happens. If you're injured in an accident, as well as two or three other people by one person, and let's suppose that one person has ordinary policy of $50,000 per person, $100,000 per accident, but there's three, four, five of you hurt. You're going to divide the per accident limits up into little bitty pieces. You may have bought $50,000, $100,000 uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage to protect yourself just in the event that the deadbeat bad driver hurts you so that you can be paying your medicals and your wage loss and your pain and suffering as if that bad driver had your levels of UM/UIM. So you would logically think when that one insurance limit, 5100, is split into little bitty pieces, that if you got 15,000, that you bought a 50,100, that you could at least get the difference between 15 and 50 from your own carrier, because that's why you buy underinsured motorist coverage, right? Well, there was a case. Actually, it's been held for quite a long time, before 1997, that the way the statute read, that instead of looking at what you actually recovered, our statutes were written in terms of how the policies on paper compare without thinking about how many people are actually hurt breaking into little bitty pieces. So what would happen is, traditionally, you'd look at those policies and say, the deadbeat had 5,100, you've got 5,100. By definition, that car that injured you and put you in the hospital for 6 months is not underinsured. It's got the same limits. So you can't get your own coverage to make up that difference between 15 and 50. Well, the good news is, in 1997, you, the legislature, recognized that problem, and in a Senate bill at that time, you changed some language in 742.502. The problem was we overlooked some earlier language in the same statute, which just read, you know how statutes read with a lot of the same language over and over. We didn't fix the earlier language. The problem being that today, we now know because of your fix that if there's 250-100 policies or anything bigger, they'll still pay UIM like you trust that it would. The problem is, if you have two minimum limits policies of 2550, you know, 2550 on the at-fault driver, 2550 on you, the injured person, if that 2550 split up in little bitty pieces, there is still a credible argument to be made under the language of 502 that you lose, and you won't get your own underinsured motorist coverage even for that. Because, and think of it, most people do drive around with minimum limits. A lot of troubled drivers don't buy much more than the minimum, and a lot of people who get hurt don't have much more than minimum. But you would like to think that if you've got $25,000 UM, and I'll call it UIM, underinsured, that you can get the balance between the 15 you might get in the little piece and the 25 as well. So Senate Bill 923, takes a lot of words to say all that, is real simple in tweaking the language in 502 to make it clear that the frame of reference is not just the face of the policy of the offending driver, but it's the actual amount that you, the hurt person, recover. And then there's a subsection 5 there that sort of says in plain English what some of the minor tweaking in the earlier phrases really mean. And that's the gist of 923.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Any comments from either side of the aisle here?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, again, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. Mr. DeVore has laid out the problem, and I don't want to duplicate what he did as far as testimony. There are very few things I think would be helpful to the committee. One is I participated on the subgroup as a member of the commission, as did Tom Mortland of North Pacific and Liberty Company, as well as some insurance defense attorneys. We had a broad base that arrived at this legislation. The second thing is that the fix that Mr. DeVore just explained to you, some companies, including my company, the way our policy already reads gives you this benefit. So if this bill passes, there's a significant number of companies that it's not going to impact how they do business today because they already chose to have their policies written that way.
Mr. Jackson, any comment?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I also served on the work group, and I would concur that this is a glitch that was just overlooked and it needs to be fixed, and it would be appropriate to do that at this time. Oregon Trial Lawyers supports this proposal.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments on this bill from the committee? Well, in the interest of stay there. I'm going to close the public hearing only on Senate Bill 923. And we have a dash one amendment.
Chair Metzger, I can actually speak to the amendment. I've forgotten I meant to do that because I actually asked for that amendment. But what the amendment does is it does not affect anything substantive that Mr. DeVore was talking about. As legislative counsel put this together for us, as they often do, they try to clean up areas of the statute they feel like need to be modernized and language done better. What they did was they in the area of the statute, what happens is uninsured motorist benefits are the same as your uninsured motorist benefits, subtracting off the underlying coverage that you recover from the other person. The idea being that you buy $100,000 with a coverage, you always be guaranteed $100,000 with a compensation, but how much your company pays decreases as the other person's insurance pays. By dropping the word benefits there, I was contacted by some folks in the insurance industry that felt it raised some ambiguity as to whether you still were deducting from limits or not. Mm-hmm. Because of that, I did ask to have the word benefits restored. It does not make a substantive effect on what the bill will do, but I think it prevents some ambiguity that might have otherwise occurred.
And the party's in agreement on that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 923, and we have a dash one amendment before us.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 923.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 923. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Move Senate Bill 923 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 923 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I'll carry that one. Okay, and then we're going to go back to our public hearing, and we're up to Senate Bill 924.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 924 deals with stolen cars in your own uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. This is a situation that you would think is like lightning and would never happen more than once in one place. But believe it or not, it happens periodically. The problem starts with a very good rule that's in the UM statute and in all the policies, which is there's a rule in all of the policies that says your own insured car under this policy cannot be treated as an uninsured car. It makes a lot of sense because you've got your own liability coverage and so forth. The problem with that is a rare circumstance that keeps happening, which is this. And I saw this in the newspaper in Eugene Register Guard this spring. The case that this came out of was a case out of Portland, Cole versus Farmers Insurance. Senator, one of your colleagues has had, Charlie Ringo has had the same thing happen to a client. The insured come home and you find a thief is stealing your car, or you may come to your parking place and you try to prevent the theft. That's how this injury happens. The case in the Register Guard in Eugene this spring was the woman stuck her arm through the window and the thief rolled up the window and drove off down the street dragging. I heard the story here in your chambers about your other incident involved somebody being drugged 90 feet across the Safeway parking lot. The person injured wants to make a claim. Typically, the thief will not have liability insurance. If they do, the situation doesn't happen. But the thing is, you would say, all right, that person was driving that car, then the car insurance ought to pay for the liability of that nasty thief. But it's your own policy, and that thief did not have your consent to be driving your car. They don't have your coverage if they don't have your permission. So there's no liability coverage. So you go, well, it's logical I should collect for that uninsured deadbeat thief who stole my car and drug me across the parking lot. But you can't, because that general rule that says your insured car is not an uninsured car by definition. So you'd like to collect for your own injuries on your own UM insurance, which you bought just in case some deadbeat didn't have insurance. And you can't because it happens to be your own car. So the fix here, which is narrow, is simply to say in the case when it's a stolen car, your insured car can be treated as an uninsured car. How we go about doing it in this bill is we look at something that's kind of analogous. We call it a phantom car. You know, it's, you know, that you know about a hit and run car. Well, the variation on that is if the car doesn't actually hit you, but the headlights are in your lane and you take the ditch and hit a tree, you can't claim contact. Well, we call that a phantom car. The way the policies and the statute treat that is if you report it to the police in 24 hours and you give a statement to your carrier, that phantom car is an uninsured car. We do the same thing with a stolen car. We say if you report it to the police in 24 hours, you cooperate with your insurer or you cooperate with the prosecution, et cetera, we'll treat that stolen car, you know, as an uninsured car so you can collect your own coverage. And that's all Senate Bill 924 is about.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a fascinating story. And one of those other things that when I read that originally, I couldn't believe that's how it happened. But anyway, that's why we're glad you have people in the Law Commission looking at these things. Mr. Merle, Mr. Jackson, comments at all on this piece of legislation?
Chair, Mr. Members of the Committee, again, for the record, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm. Three things I'd just like to very quickly cover with the bill. One, this is a problem that has been brought to our attention before. We actually worked with Senator Ringo on a bill last session to fix the problem because of other business that the committee that where it was at had. It got a hearing, but it never got going. But we worked with him, and this bill is somewhat modeled after that again. The other thing is that cost of insurance, what will this do to it? That's what we're always here telling you about. This happens repetitively, but it happens on a small scale. I've talked to our actuarial department. We feel like that adding this, it will broaden the UM coverage, but we don't think it will be actuarially significant. And in other words, normal fluctuations in the market, you wouldn't even notice that this actually had been added in, so we don't anticipate a problem there. The last thing that I want to put on the record, and I put in the report that I wrote for the Oregon Law Commission on this bill, is that there are provisions about cooperation for the insured. When we were in the committee doing that, adding that in there, we wanted it to be clear the kind of cooperation we're talking about is not that the person has to go to the end of the earth to help with prosecution, but that it's the same body of law that deals with cooperation under liability coverage should be applied to that type of cooperation. Mr. Jackson, the other members on the committee, I think all agreed that that body of law and cooperation had considerable consumer protection while getting at the point of making sure that they help bring the thief to account, and it's that type of cooperation that we're talking about.
And so that's what we're looking at on page 3, lines 13, 14, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I served on the work group and worked with the gentleman before you. The trial lawyers are in favor of this. We think it's about time, and fully support it and urge your support.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? We have defined phantom vehicle in this bill for the first time. So, any other questions? Any questions? What's the wish of the committee? No, but if we are, I will go. All right, let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 924. Open a work session, Senate Bill 924.
I move Senate Bill 924 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starrs moves Senate Bill 924 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starrs, you want to carry that?
Sure.
Okay. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 924 and return to our hearing on now Senate Bill 925. Mr. DeFore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 925 is a bit less of something that has a direct impact on the consumer, but it has more to do with the process of disputes between insurance companies and sometimes with the consumer. It has to do with overlapping insurance policies. When you have two policies that cover the same injured person, who pays first? We're talking about, again, UM and UIM insurance. Our current statute, ORS 742-542, has been called by the courts as a model minimum policy that insurers can follow. The trouble with this one subsection 9 of 742-504 is it is no model of clarity. It you can read it a dozen times and not understand what it means. The problem is that insurers fight between each other as to who pays first, or sometimes there'll be arguments with claimants as to who pays or how much. And what simply happens with this proposal is that we clarify the language so that it means what we think most people understand it to mean. Just we simply, no substantive changes are intended. It's just to say in plain English what 742-504 sub 9 was intended to mean. Subsection 9A will simply provide that if the insured's coverage is primary when occupying the insured's own car. When the insured person is in somebody else's car, then that insured person's coverage becomes excess. It's the car's coverage that's primary. No particular magic about that. The current statute allows the policies to include anti-stacking language, so that means the highest of the two will pay its limits, but not necessarily stack. But we make no changes in the law. It's also possible for consumers to go out and buy stacking coverage if they want, and that was important to our work group, that we don't do anything to change the right to go out and buy stacking if you want. But what we wanted to do was just clarify who pays first, and that's all 925 does.
Thank you. What the industry perspective, please.
Chair Metzger, member of the committee, again, I'm Steve Merle, claim attorney for State Farm Insurance. I think Mr. DeVore has described it correctly. This is mainly a clarification. I think the language that we're putting in there is what everybody, or the majority of people, understood to be the order of who pays first.
Mr. Jackson.
Neil Jackson for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I would concur with the statements made by Mr. DeVore and Mr. Merle. Trial lawyers are in favor of this. We think it clears it up. And it's simply, we see it as a matter of basically letting the carriers know what order they need to stand in line. And it makes it clear. So we're in support.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for the committee? Okay, let's see if we can do a hat trick here. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 925 and open a work session on Senate Bill 925. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 925 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 925 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Deckert, would you carry that bill?
I would be honored and delighted.
Okay. Senator Deckard will care. Now we'll return to public hearing, Senate Bill 926. Mr. DeFore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. 926 is a consumer fix. It deals with an odd situation. It deals with the problem that happens when liability insurance companies become insolvent. Now, it makes sense to think that if the liability insurance company for the bad driver goes insolvent, that your uninsured motorist coverage would be triggered. And, of course, it is. Because that circumstance, that's why you buy UM. It turns out the person did have insurance, but the insurance still doesn't pay, so you get your uninsured motorist coverage. Or underinsured motorist coverage, because there's the potential that the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association will kick in, but it has limits of $300,000, and you might have bought $500,000 or $1 million in underinsured motorist coverage. So both are important to you when that insurer goes insolvent. But here's the problem. For some reason, when the statute was written, and it was written in 65, adopted in 67, there's a lot of things here that people didn't contemplate. Insurance companies can become insolvent longer than 2 years after an accident. It's entirely and what's remarkable is, I think in most of our practices, somebody has always got work that they're doing that involves a claim with an insolvent insurance company. There always seem to be insolvent insurance companies around. I don't know why. They're certainly not State Farm and other good companies. But it happens. And if it happens 2 years and 1 month after the accident, you cannot get your uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage because the statute, for some reason, has a condition in the definition. It says an uninsured motor vehicle will include a vehicle whose insurer becomes insolvent within 2 years after the accident. Well, what if it's 3 years? Because claims very often are litigated. They take longer. The injured party may not be medically stable until a year, year and a half, when they start the lawsuit. And then the lawsuit starts and it goes along, and then, surprise, somebody's insolvent. And it's outside of the two-year window, even though the claim has progressed normally. So it, to us, makes no sense to have a two-year limitation. Serves no one's particular benefit or interest. And the only person that gets shortchanged is the injured party. So the fix here is very simple. It's to remove the two-year limit in that definition that relates to the insolvency of the liability insurer. And that's 926.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. It's very clear. Industry perspective, Mr. Merle.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. The only thing I'd like to talk to you about is impact on the industry. You should know that there are a large number of companies, my company included, who do not have this two-year limitation in their policy. So when this bill passes, what it will do is bring the rest of the companies that do have the two-year limitation, which is authorized by the statute, in the line with what a lot of the other companies are doing. I think industry-wide there will be minimal impact.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, again, I'm Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. This situation that Mr. DeVore has addressed and this bill addresses, it does happen. And it's not that infrequent that it happens. Within the last 3 months, we received notice that a carrier had gone bankrupt, and everybody was scrambling, going, okay, what do we do? Where do we go? And we talked about the Guarantee Association and all that. This is a good bill, and it solves that little glitch that the 2 years, and again, State Farm doesn't do it, but some of the companies do, and the trial lawyers are in support of this on behalf of their clients.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. Let's see where we go. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 926 and open a work session on Senate Bill 926.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 926 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 926 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Order. Senator Monis Anderson, you want to complete the...
I would love to.
All right.
Senator Atkinson, I thought he mentioned to me he wanted to carry that bill.
We're going
to
let him. We got a couple others in mind for him. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 926, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 922, and we'll start with our trio. And if you would go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. 922 involves two different but related problems involving what we call self-insured cars. The first problem has to do with the, we'll call it liability in quotes, coverage that a self-insurer provides And the second part deals with what happens to your uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage when you're hit by a self-insured car. Two different problems, but they're related. The as to the liability side of this, what I need to explain as kind of a premise is that we all know that if we drive or we own a car, we have to go out and buy insurance. It's sort of the predicate for being on the road in Oregon. That is as a result of something we call the financial responsibility law. Mostly it's in ORS Chapter 806. Some of it's in 742. Now, one of the other important fundamentals of the financial responsibility law is that your policy, or mine, any of us, when we buy an standard insurance policy from State Farm or anyone else, it must cover permissive users, anyone who drives with our consent, whether it's a family member or a neighbor or a friend or a visitor. If we give consent, they're covered under our policy. They may have their own policy too, but one of the fundamentals of the financial responsibility law is to make sure that injured victims have insurance to pay. It may be that the driver has no insurance of their own, so the important requirement is every car owner must have coverage on the car that covers permissive users. Okay, that's my little sermon. The problem comes about because some businesses can self-insure. You can satisfy the financial responsibility law by buying a policy, but if you happen to be one of the lucky people that owns 25 cars, like a utility or like a rental car company, you can self-insure, and all you have to do to self-insure is promise to, quote, pay the same amounts as an insurance company would, and then we'll come back to that. That's the catch. And you go get a certificate of self-insurance from the Department of Transportation, and you're in business. You don't have to pay any premiums. You're off the hook. You don't have to go buy an insurance policy, but you promise to pay the same amounts. Well, the problem is that if you self-insure, the surprise is you don't have to cover permissive users. Now, if it happens to be your employee, like a utility, that's not going to be a problem because the utility is going to get sued anyway. But it's going to be a problem if you give your car to the friend, if it's a take-home car from the utility in the evening, and they take home the car, you loan the pickup to the neighbor to haul some trash, or you're a rental car company, and you ask the person, do they have their insurance? Like, we're all used to going and renting a car, and they'll say, do you have your own coverage? Yes, I do. I have my State Farm coverage from my friend here. But the problem that happens, and it happens in claims files with predictable regularity, is the person who said they had coverage does not. Either because their coverage was canceled, or they lied, or their divorcing spouse up and canceled everybody's coverage. Who knows? But there's a variety of reasons why the driver turns out to be uninsured. The problem that happens with something like a self-insured car, then, that's been loaned to someone with consent, is they injure you. They will provide the self-insurance. It's supposed to pay the same amounts as an insurance company. But in a decision that happened about 1994, the court looked at the words pay the same amounts. They said, well, that means pay the same amounts, like at least $25.50 is the minimum required. But there's nothing in there that says you have to provide the same scope of coverage, meaning consensual drivers. You don't have to. It doesn't tell you when you have to pay the same amounts. So the big catch in self-insured cars are we would all assume that they're providing the same thing because they're supposed to pay the same amounts as insurance, but in fact they don't when it comes to permissive users. So if you get hit by somebody driving dollar rent-a-car whose insurance was covered, you'll get nothing. Nothing from that driver and nothing from that car owner, even though that car owner agency is in the business of putting cars on the roads in Oregon. You'll still get nothing from them either because there was no employee involved, so you can't sue them either. So they're supposed to self-insure to pay the same amounts, but actually there's a hole in the self-insurance law that allows them to deduct coverage for drivers like that. So the fix in 920, the first fix on 922, is simply to make a cross-reference in the self-insurance statute 806.130 to make a cross-reference that points over to the financial responsibility law, because
Well, I digress. In 1989, you're looking at the guy who lost the case for insurance companies when representing insurance companies. I went to the Oregon Supreme Court and said, hey, we don't have to cover permissive users. And the Oregon Supreme Court said, by gosh, you sure do. Every insurance policy must. It's a fundamental of the financial responsibility law. And what more, the legislature, after that 1989 decision, tweaked ORS 806.080 to put in plain language right in the financial responsibility law that if you buy a policy, you must cover drivers with permission. 922 in the first fix makes a cross-reference to that language in the financial responsibility law to require people, if they're supposed to pay the same amounts as insurance, if they're going to get out of paying premiums, then they've got to cover the same when times too. So that's the first fix on 922, which is probably going to draw your comment. 922 Part B has to do with the underinsured or the uninsured motorist coverage. Because here's the part: if you thought that was a little peculiar, that self-insurance doesn't really have to insure at all, this gets even better. The car that hit you, not only did the driver not have insurance, it was canceled or whatever, and not only does Magic Rent-A-Car get to walk because they don't have to cover consensual drivers like every other car owner in the state does, but you turn that now to your own uninsured motorist coverage and say, look what happened to me. I'd like the $50,000-$100,000 coverage that I paid from my wages, the whole thing. I bought this insurance to protect me, and now it's happened. And what you'll find in our statute and in most all of the policies is when you look at the definition of what is an uninsured car, they'll say it's this and that, but they'll say an uninsured car, it says it in our Oregon statute, does not include a self-insured car. Well, that was probably written for a couple of reasons. It was written back in 65 when everybody assumed that if you were self-insured, you'd get paid money. But now we know after the Farmer Snappy Car case, if it's a permissive user, you may not get paid anything. So you will get denied your own UIM coverage because it's a self-insured car. If the part one of this passes, the liability part that I'm talking about, it would do no more than to require every self-insurer, whether it's Northwest Natural Gas or Budget Rent-A-Car or whoever it may be, all they have to do is provide the minimal coverage that everybody else does on a car of $2,550. But if you get your $2,550 and don't fix Part 2 of Senate Bill 922, what will happen is you'll get your $2,550, but you may have paid $100,000, bought $100,000 worth of coverage, but you've still got this quirk in the UM statute that says a self-insured car is not an uninsured car, and you won't get your own coverage, even if you do fix Part 1 and require them to have liability, self-insurers to have the minimum liability coverage. You still won't get your own UM coverage, or I should say underinsured motorist coverage for the balance that you bought. So 922 tweaks the language to make it clear that if the self-insured car doesn't pay as much as you've bought limits for, you're entitled to get what you paid for in UM or UIM. And that's 922.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, again, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. Of the law commission bills that you have before you today, I think this one has the most important public policy component, that it takes something that's been somewhat ignored of saying, well, our premise has been that the owner needs to provide some sort of financial responsibility when they put a car on the road. What this will do is it will make self-insurers and insurers provide the same dollar amount minimum and the same scope of coverage minimum. Currently, particularly with the rental car industry, there are methods for if I have insurance and I rent a car, the rental car industry has a mechanism within statute to shift it where my insurance goes first. The important part of this particular bill will be that instance where somebody gets into a rental car without insurance for whatever reason, and that then it will make the rental car company or the whatever self-insurer that's out there go ahead and provide that financial responsibility minimum, which I think is what the public policy of Oregon has always been directed at. It's just a glitch that needs to be fixed.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, Neil Jackson on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I concur with everything Mr. DeVore and Mr. Morrell have said, but I would add this one thing. There's a case that came out December 23rd of last year, 2004, called May Haynes versus TriMet.
I won't go into the details of that case, but I would predict to this committee that based on the language of that case, all the car rental companies in this state in the next 4 or 5 years, as the cases go on appeal, are going to be forced to provide the coverage that the insurance companies provide. That language in that case, the Supreme Court just threw out a red flag and said, you better start acting like insurers if you're self-insured. The problem with that in relation to the bill that's before you today is we think that the problem needs to be solved now. Let's make it clear now what the Supreme Court, I think, has projected in the Haynes case, that self-insurers, they're putting the cars on the road. If they choose not to pay the premiums, they choose to go the self-insurance route, they simply better provide the same coverage that State Farm and all the other companies do. They're getting an economic benefit from the rental of these vehicles. They're in the business to make money. Well, they need to provide the protection to the public that we all have to do when we go out and buy our policies. The second part of the bill that was addressed by Mr. DeVore also we think is equally important. We think you need to make it clear that self-insurers have to provide the same scope of coverage and insurance companies do, and also provide the consumers with access to their own UIM coverage in the event that there's minimum coverage that is applied from the liability carrier, the rental car. They should be able to access their own policy for the coverage they paid for. So we're strongly in support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. I have a question. Either Mr. Jackson or Mr. Merle might be able to answer this. In this case in which you have a permissive driver and they say they're insured, say in the rental car situation, but they weren't, and you have this accident, et cetera, and maybe prior order perspective may trump this, I don't know, but from the defense, from the industry standpoint, I'd be curious your response. Is there any right of action that I would have? Let's say I'm that guy who got hurt, and I go, I can say, well, he told us he was, and so you're out of luck. We're not going to do anything about it. Do I have a right of action saying because they led me to believe that this was proper because they accepted the driver's comment, saying that he was uninsured? I mean, would I have a right of action saying that's not good enough, buddy? I'm going to sue you because you didn't do sufficient due diligence to ensure my safety.
The problem, Mr. Chairman, Neil Jackson again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the problem with that scenario is that I think inevitably it's going to hinge on the facts. And the facts are very likely going to be that the person, the permissive user, who was the renter of the car, walked in there and had an insurance card with them. And I can tell you as a practical matter, if they had an insurance card and they showed that card and it said they had coverage through the period of time of the rental, you're going nowhere with that lawsuit. Nowhere. You'll lose.
Chairman Metzger, again, Steve Merle, for the record. I concur with what Mr. Jackson said. Some states have solved this problem by having owner's liability statutes. If you look at Idaho, they have a form of an owner liability statute where they make the owner responsible for damages up to the financial responsibility minimums. Oregon hasn't gone that direction. We've just gone the direction of saying everybody has to provide coverage, except for this one little hole that we have now of this particular kind of permissive user that makes it through the cracks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I might add, about the only Joel DeVore, the only angle that I can think of is if the car rental company negligently entrusted the car to someone who was stinking drunk at the time.
Yeah.
You could make a claim against them, but other than that, you generally can't chase a car owner here. Speaking of statutes, we spot checked about 10 states trying to see what do other states do about rental car companies, and we found 7 out of the 10 that we checked require rental car companies to have coverage on the car, whether it's primary or secondary. And those were California, Florida, Georgia, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, and New York. And Oregon ought to be there.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Senator Decker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. DeVore, this just conforms with those 7 states, then. This
yes.
would be conforming language.
Right. Probably easier than some of those states that require it to be primary, because this wouldn't necessarily be required to be primary insurance at all. If the person has their own coverage, that's what's going to pay, and it'll pay their the 25, and that's all that this would require anyway. So if their own policy pays 25, that's fine. The other states might have put the company first, but this just does not.
Okay. Other questions for this group? Okay, thank you. Mr. Burt, would you stay there, please, just and then dismiss the other two and ask Jim Garter and Al Elkins. I only got 3 chairs. They're going to tell us why they don't want to do this. I have a funny feeling. No, well, we'll see.
Pharma?
Why they don't want to pay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Hertz, and Al Elkins is with me representing Catrala. I want to clarify what I think are a couple of misunderstandings. The first is that in this situation of a permissive driver and a self-insured rental car company, it is the policy to walk away when it turns out that the driver does not have coverage. That is not Hertz's policy. It's corporate policy. Our policy is to regard ourselves, our company, as essentially in a secondary position. And if, in fact, our renter has lied to us or the insurance has lapsed, we will step up to the statutory minimum and provide the coverage. The problem is that as our corporate counsel reads this bill, it is not stated that the coverage that Hertz is expected to provide is secondary. This is an issue about priority of coverage. And I'll give you an example of what I think this is really about. And I'm reading a sentence from the position paper provided by the Oregon Law Commission. This is on page 3. First, right at the bottom, first, self-insured vehicles do not provide coverage for permissive drivers. As in the Snappy Car case, there may be no money at all. There may be no money at all. Now, if you look at the Snappy Car decision, you will find this sentence, and this is Farmers Insurance was the plaintiff in that case. It was a case for contribution, basically a battle between Snappy Car Rental and the insurance company. And it said, plaintiff subsequently settled those claims for $17,500. The parties agreed that the settlement amount was reasonable. In other words, money went out the door to compensate the victim in this case. That case was about a battle between the car rental company and the insurance company, and the issue was whether or not the insurance company would get to pick up part of it, what it paid out from the car rental company. Now, in principle, Hertz would not have an objection to a codification of what is already our corporate practice, which is to stand in a secondary position. That's not how we read this bill. We read this bill as a flat-out repeal of the Snappy Car Rental case.
Can you tell me, Mr. Gardner, whereabouts, if you could, part in the bill that gives you the big heartburn problem?
Well, it's basically the essence of the bill is to take away, to put self-insureds and regular insureds in a position of exact parity. And that may be in some sense a proper policy direction, but it simply doesn't work in our circumstance, as I think evidenced by the fact that, and the most important part of the testimony that you heard just a minute ago was at the very end, where it distinguished between those, alluded to the fact that in some states there's a codification that the car rental company's liability is secondary. That is what we think would be an appropriate approach to this, and I have a suggestion as to how to accomplish that. We think that a couple of things would be useful to the committee. The first would be for us to get a sense of the extent to which Hertz's operating policy, which is to step up in a secondary capacity, to what extent that is a policy that's shared industry-wide. I simply don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether or not there are major car rental companies or even minor car rental companies that are simply walking away, relying on the Snappy decision and simply turning their back on a person that was injured by a permissive driver who turned out not to have coverage. I don't know what the answer to that is. The second is to clarify that we're talking about secondary liability, not co-primary liability. It would be our preference, because these issues are complex. The interaction with the UIM statute is complicated. To have essentially a second a go at this with ourselves explicitly included as industry participants in a working group with the Law Commission over the interim and have a chance to really refine that. And I think the question of the urgency of this maybe depends on the first issue, is the extent to which our policy and practice is an industry practice.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Elkins, anything to add to this?
No, sir.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to ask Mr. Murrow, the reason I asked you to stay here, is to kind of comment on the observations that Mr. Gardner has made.
Again, Chair Mesker, for the record, my name is Steve Murrow. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. Mr. Gardner is correct. Hertz has a very different and progressive policy when it comes to this issue. In fact, I think that if I remember seeing their contracts in the past, not only did they provide coverage, but they actually said that they will commit to a particular type of form contract. I have found that in my experience to be the exception to the rule. There are other major carriers out there that don't take that position, and Hertz is different. As to whether who's primary or secondary, I think I can actually help Mr. Gardner with this. A new chapter that was opened up last legislative session, ORS Chapter 31, took a number of statutes out of ORS Chapter 18 and put in there. One of those statutes that is now in ORS Chapter 31 provides a mechanism for a rental car company, or basically a car business. Doesn't matter if it's your mechanic, doesn't matter if it's a car dealer, doesn't matter if it's a Hertz rental car, where they can shift by agreement in writing at the time that they do the rental contract the primary liability on the renter's insurance. That mechanism is in our statutes. It's there today if the rental car companies use their business practices to avail themselves of it. So as far as who's primary, who's secondary, I think that mechanism exists today.
I'm not familiar with that, and I'll be delighted to check that out and report back to the committee.
Okay. So then, my question, Mr. Gardner, for you then would be, because from what I hear you saying is that you don't disagree with this policy. It's other that you think there are unintended consequences. There's a dispute as to whether that happens in terms of the primary secondary.
Exactly.
So we need to resolve that issue, and to clarify, you know, how this is actually applicable, but that from an industry standpoint, you have already made that decision that you recognize that these basic principles are correct, that we need to cover these folks.
Yes, in fact, but in a position of a secondary capacity to the, and I guess the issue of the contractual, and I appreciate the mention of the Chapter 31, and I will look at that very carefully. The issue, I think, still remains whether or not, because this applies to, you know, other self-insureds as well as rental car companies, whether or not it's a good idea to clarify that exposure is across the board's secondary.
Mm-hmm. Questions from the committee? Mr. Perry, I saw you kind of creep up here. Would you like to have a comment on that at all before we adjourn?
I simply wanted to say that I'm sensitive to Mr. Gardner's point that it's excess. If ORS Chapter 31 doesn't solve the problem, it would be very easy to add the paragraph into 806.130. I mean, I even have language at the bottom of my page where I worried about the very thing. I could leave that with the committee and share it with Mr. Gardner. You can simply say nothing in the section shall prevent a self-insurer, blah, 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 from being excess, and you could even borrow language. What happens in the financial responsibility law is if an insurance company is required to provide coverage, you normally wouldn't. There's a provision there where the insurance company who got stuck can go chase the person who didn't buy the insurance, et cetera. You could even put the same language in that little paragraph, 742.460 is the provision, so that Hertz or whoever, if they got stuck, could go chase after the person that fibbed to them, that should have had coverage. You could put that paragraph right into the bill as easy as could be to make double sure if Chapter 31 doesn't already do it.
Yes, Mr. Murrow.
Chair Metzger, one comment I would like to make is that if we're in the primary secondary issue, I think that that's an important issue for rental car companies. I don't think it's appropriate where there's a lot of other self-insurers is for employers. I'm a big employer, and I let you loose with self-insurance. I don't think it's as important to them, and I think anything we do ought to limit it not applying to that.
Right. The language that I drafted was restricted to commercial renter of vehicles. So, I mean, I can share that with the committee. If that might address the concern, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. First of all, questions? Any other questions in the committee?
Well,
yes, Senator Deckard.
So just a comment. My interest would be, and maybe it's just refining the language on it, is to codify Hertz's good policy. Mm-hmm. Because to me that is the right policy, where it's primary and then secondary, and just capturing that in statute would be my, I guess, one vote on this.
Mm-hmm. Other comments, questions? I think, gentlemen, and I appreciate the discussion and the analysis here, and you guys are the certifiably smart people on this issue. And it does sound, as we had at some of the earlier bills this afternoon, definitely there is an understanding that I believe can be reached here to achieve the objective that apparently you all share. It's just a little difference in terms of comfort zone as to whether the law really articulates that. So I would ask that Mr. Merle, Mr. DeFore, I'll let you guys from the Law Commission advocates working with Mr. Gardner and Mr. Elkins, if by the I would like by the end of the week to know whether we can resolve this issue with your efforts, and then report back please to Ms. Van Winkle as to whether you have been able collectively to solve that issue, and then depending on your answer we will decide what the committee wants to do. But I think there's some you folks can probably decipher that, and I would ask that you do that. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 922, and we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you very much.